Spirit Radio Podcasts.
The United States prepare to inaugurate a new president in Joe Biden next week. This will happen on the 20th of January. But the November 2020 presidential election campaign and, of course, the events that have followed have presented huge challenges to American democracy that are really different to anything they've experienced before. Earlier on, Spirit Radio's Steve Johnson talked to former Time magazine journalist David Aikman about this unique episode in the history of the United States of America. And the first thing that Steve chatted to David about was if he agreed that 2020 had thrown up challenges to US democracy that the country hadn't experienced before.
I would say this was a very unique election for a variety of reasons, one of which, of course, was the COVID virus, which restricted how often and when people could come together or go to different events or have any kind of proximity with each other. But there's also been a relentless challenge from opponents of President Trump, mostly from the Democratic side, but also even from the conservative side of the Republican Party, who have detested everything about the man. And this is the culmination of 4 years of relentless sniping at him and attempts to pull him down. I mean, if you go back to the original impeachment and then the Russian collusion charges, there's just been an incessant pattern of attacks on his ability to function as a governing president. I don't think I, even in the Nixon campaign, Nixon era, I don't think there was this degree of animosity.
The election itself was closer than expected. What do you think the voting patterns showed?
Well, I think what they showed, I mean, this you can tell from some of the results in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. I think it showed that support for Trump was much higher than people had anticipated, certainly than the pollsters had anticipated. So, for example, the Republicans, who had been a minority in the GOP since the election in 2018, nevertheless gained several seats to the House of Representatives, coming to the point where they almost overtook the Democrats and became the majority party. That didn't happen, but I think it showed, and subsequent examination of the record shows, that there was a much higher degree of support for Trump than most people had anticipated.
So let's talk about that. The result was contested. Like, you've seen it all, and maybe it was a little bit like the Bush-Gore standoff in 2000, but it was different too because that focused just on the voting in one state, in the state of Florida. Do you think there was substance to the challenges put forward by the Trump team?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, one of the biggest misapprehensions of the media on this side of the Atlantic, certainly by the BBC and Sky News, was that they repeatedly said there was no evidence of voter fraud. But in fact, there were hundreds of pages of sworn affidavits by people who, if they had been proved in court to have lied or to have perjured themselves, they would have faced a prison sentence. And I think these affidavits ranged from the fairly minor, like voter observers not being permitted to see when the ballots were arriving, to actual seeing whole boxfuls of ballots being hidden under a table and then brought up to be counted in the middle of the night. And the other thing about the election anomaly is that in several parts of the country, on the night of November 3 and 4, the voting stopped inexplicably for 2 or 3 hours in the early morning and then resumed without any explanation. And there were various reports of water damage in one of the counting locations in Pennsylvania that turned out to be completely fraudulent. I think there were so many things that didn't really add up. And then the numbers changed from about 10 in the evening on the 3rd to 6 in the morning on the 4th, as people seemed to have completely different tabulation results in different counties of the United States. And so all of these things were really most unusual for a general election. And that led, I think, to the feeling that something really hadn't gone right at all.
I know, David, that here in Ireland, there are some people who are just fascinated, you know, and absolutely passionate about vote tallying and things like that. And I'm sure it's the same in the US. Do you think over time more will be heard on these events?
Well, I'll tell you what I predict, Steve. I predict in about 2 years' time, a book will come out called something like The Election of November 2020, and it will win a Pulitzer Prize, and it will be a blow-by-blow account of what happened in the election. And I think it will substantially illustrate the point claimed by the Trump camp that there was massive fraud in this election, to the extent that in swing states, the electoral vote was completely falsely listed for Biden when the numbers actually supported Trump's presidency.
Now, last Wednesday, the 6th of January, saw the storming of Capitol Hill, which resulted in the deaths of 5 people. Now, as someone, you yourself, having covered major world events, what were your thoughts watching that footage last week?
Well, first of all, it was obvious the Trump supporters who had gathered for a rally, which was addressed by Trump initially, were stirred up by the thought that they'd been cheated out of an election victory. So they were certainly turbulent and, well, I would say turbulent, but they were certainly angry. And then they trotted down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. And at which point, I think it became unclear who was leading home, because there have been several affidavits that some of the Antifa supporters, who are, of course, anarchist and Marxist, were completely opposed to the whole Trump pattern, but they were infiltrated into the leadership of the crowd that actually stormed the Capitol. So, I mean, there's no doubt that some Trump supporters clearly misbehaved, but the extent to which it was they who initiated the invasion of the Capitol, or simply followed where Antifa and others had gone ahead, is not clear.
But do you think Trump has got himself into difficulty by the way in which he addressed the crowd in the first place and sort of encouraging them to march on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, I do. I think he... Well, he didn't say anything that specifically incited his followers to invade the Capitol, but he said things like, we've really got to fight, we've got to be strong, which are things that other political leaders are always saying in times of stress. So he clearly didn't incite the demonstrators specifically to sack the Capitol. But you could argue that his words were inflammatory and that they encouraged his supporters basically to push their biggest impetus through against whatever was in front of them. And it definitely has responsibility for that.
Like it's one thing to say something like that in South Carolina or Ohio.
That's right, yeah.
But in the nation's capital.
Right, particularly at a time of great... sort of polarized stress in the country.
So what can we expect now, David? Will there be a smooth transition of power to Joe Biden?
I think there will, actually, because Trump has said that there won't be any obstacles, that he's trying to do everything possible to have a smooth follow-on. Added to which, if there were any obstacles, Trump would pay for it in the fact that he's been impeached now twice in his first term in office by the House of Representatives, and he could be found guilty by the Senate, particularly if he tried anything in the last few days in office to slow down Biden's progress. So I don't think he will do anything to unhinge the transition.
Spirit. One of the homes examined in the report of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation was a home run by the Bonsecours sisters in Tuam in Galway. Now, for the last number of years, my next guest, who's a native of Tuam, has been helping former residents of this home to trace their families. And he's with me now to tell us a little bit about this and also to give his reaction to the report. It's great to have with me writer and student at NUI Galway, Luke Silk. Luke, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy. How are things?
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved with this particular home in Tuam in the first place.
Yeah, so when I was in transition year in secondary school, I wrote a book on the history of the townland where I grew up. And I suppose mushrooming then from that, as copies of the book were sold and everything, lots of people started getting in touch with me just as this story about the Tuam home was breaking, to see if I could help them in trying to find more about their past and their families and their birth parents and everything.
A big ask when you think you were only in transition year, Luke. Were you surprised that people were getting in touch with you?
I was surprised. Now, I suppose I do enjoy the work that I do. I love local history and researching and trying to put the jigsaw puzzle together for people who are looking to find more information on their family. So I did actually enjoy doing it.
So what happened next then? Tell us a little bit about some of the people that you've helped in the last number of years.
Yeah, well, what I found, it was quite a frustrating process, as it is with anyone who is adopted really in this country. The way you go about it, if you're looking to find your mother, you will write to Tusla, and Tusla will contact your mother if she's still alive, and then ask her, does she want to receive a letter from you? And what usually happens next is you will send a letter to Tusla, who will then forward that letter to your mother, and it's all the correspondence goes through Tusla. Now, there is, obviously, before Christmas, we had the whole sealing of the records and that controversy. And that is the problem, you see. In cases where the woman is dead and a son or a daughter is trying to get in touch with her, before giving the child or the son or daughter or the survivor any information about their mother, they will contact maybe the mother's husband, if he's still alive, or her brothers and sisters, or if they're all dead, her cousins.
So it's just such a long process.
You know,
it takes so long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would imagine for some of those people, perhaps, and I heard some of the survivors giving their testimonies where they said in the years and years of trying to find their biological parents that they had died and that they could have gotten to meet them if it hadn't taken so long.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the one thing I would say as well on that front is that I've had many survivors, you know, contact me, and they might be in their 70s. So, for example, I know one woman who's in her 70s, and she found her mother, or, you know, we got her mother, and her mother's in her 90s. So it's not that, you know, if the survivor is elderly, you have to remember that a lot of these women were very young when they gave birth. So there is still a chance, there is still that glimmer of hope that perhaps their mother is still alive, and in some cases she is.
One of the things that you did recently, Luke, was you attended the government's Zoom meeting for survivors. It seems even hard to say the fact that this, or details of this report, was delivered over Zoom. What was your impression of that meeting and how it was delivered?
Yeah, well, I didn't like the idea of the way it was done over Zoom. I didn't think that was quite appropriate. You see, for many of these survivors, and I suppose it's a difficult thing to say, but they are, in a way, scarred, or maybe troubled isn't quite the right word, but certainly a lot of these survivors are very vulnerable people. And I just didn't get the sense of love and at the meeting. And there was no opportunity, really, for them to ask questions. I mean, the Taoiseach or the minister would have said at the meeting, if you want to ask questions, you know, type it in now. But I didn't see anyone could type in a question. And afterwards at the press conference, those questions were in advance. And of course, there was the whole thing of the leak the week previously.
Yeah, I mean, imagine being one of those women and to find out the details on the front page of the papers before they even ever got a chance to fully read it themselves.
Yeah, it is incredibly difficult. And, you know, I know there's obviously technicalities and the report's fine. And these findings, in some cases, would kind of contradict them, the survivors would be saying. So a blatant example of that is, you know, there's one woman I know who would maintain that she was taken to the home by the Gardaí and a local priest. The report found there was no evidence that the Gardaí routinely notified if a woman became pregnant outside of marriage. So when the findings of this were relayed over the Zoom meeting, this lady is listening to this, which you can just imagine her sitting in her seat getting very frustrated at this statement. And because the host of the meeting muted all the microphones, she wasn't able to interject. And I just felt that was unfair, do you know?
And when you think about it, Luke, if we hadn't been in the middle of a pandemic and this was done in the Oireachtas where these people were invited to attend, they couldn't be muted, you know, their voices would have to have been heard. So that must have been very frustrating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think as well, you know, there could have been, even though we're in the pandemic, I think there could have been steps taken, you know, to ensure perhaps survivors got a physical copy of it. There were 500 survivors who testified before the commission. That's not that huge. You know, I think if they were to set up a call centre or something in the department and have a kind of a sensitive phone call with each of these survivors, it would have been doable.
And worthwhile for them, I would imagine. Mm. What about just the report in general? How did you feel about the contents of it, especially as it is detailing, you know, one of the homes that is in your homeland?
Yeah, I'm not shocked by the findings of the report. But it did still make for sad reading. You know, I did have to. I haven't read all 4,000 pages of it. I've read the kind of main briefing part, but I did have to get up off my seat and take a few minutes when I was reading it, because some of the language is difficult. There seems to be like a narrative around a room with some big secret. I don't think it was that big a secret. I think everyone kind of in this country knew there was something dark in our past in that area of the town. And I mean, growing up, we would always have known about the tomb site and the babies that were buried there. And there was a local woman and her husband, who's dead since. But they used to keep the flowers, you know, and the garden maintained on the site. And there was a priest that used to come down and say mass every year. So we did know, I suppose, that something had happened, but we didn't quite know the extent of it. And then, of course, it was Catherine Corliss's research which revealed, I suppose, how high the figure of those that died was. Now, the findings, when I say that the language was difficult, I mean, there's one sentence for me that was particularly striking, and it's in reference to a child that would be born in the home and fostered out. It says, such a child would have been especially unwelcome in a farmhouse where the marriage of an inheriting son depended on clearing the home of non-inheriting siblings. And I think that is an insight, I suppose, into the Ireland that we're talking about, an Ireland of poverty and immigration and all of this sort of thing and heartache. So it is, yeah, it's a sad week for the survivors and their families. And I think it's a difficult part of our past that we just have to face up to and read the report. I would encourage everyone to read it.
From the survivors, Luke, that you have tried to help, what do they want the most to happen now?
Well, the main issue, the priority for them, is access to information. So as I said earlier, we all remember before Christmas when the government voted to seal the records. And a lot of the survivors like that I'd be speaking to would have very basic questions. Like, there's one man, and he wants to know what age he was when he left the home. You know, there's someone else wants to know details about their biological mother. And the report doesn't answer these specific questions for them.
And even practical things like medical history.
Yeah, absolutely. What age was I when I had the measles, or did I have measles when I was a child? And I really suspect that Tuzla and the Commission, given all the digging that the Commission were doing into the history of this home, I really think they did the answers to these questions. But we know that those records are sealed. So I think it's a fairly basic ask that every single one of these survivors should be granted access to their birth cert and the documents about their time in the home. Another thing that I see Father Tobin has been calling on the government now to offer each survivor DNA testing kit. And I think that's vital. I know from my own research, it's one step that I would take if someone contacted me. You can take a test. It's with Ancestry.com or MyHeritage or another such website. And it uploads your DNA results and it lets you match from the website with relatives that you have around the world. And it will tell you how you're, not how you're related, but it will say, you know, this person in Boston is a second cousin of yours. And from there, then you can begin to build the jigsaw puzzle in finding information about your family.
About who you are. One of the things, Luke, that's probably interesting for people to know is, of course, you weren't born at the time when these events happened. It sounds like you're a man of faith, but how do you feel, you know, when you're reading these accounts and trying to connect that up to the faith that you have today?
Yeah, I am a person of faith, and I suppose I do pray. So I would have, you know, throughout my research, or if I'm trying to find someone or trying to research someone, like for me personally, prayer would form a part of that. And I would pray, you know, God help us find this woman for this survivor, and so on. Now, there's two things reading the report that I suppose challenge me in my faith. One thing that I just cannot comprehend is how people who entered religious life could drift so far away from the message of Jesus in the Gospels. And, you know, one of the examples that the report found that women, when they were giving birth, some of them were taunted by the nuns, you know, so you should have thought about this, you know, and the pain of childbirth, you should have thought about this 9 months ago and stuff like that. I just don't understand that. And the other thing, I suppose, that's really striking is that for many of the survivors, they do actually have a faith and they do believe in God. And, you know, I struggle to understand as well how they can maintain a faith, despite, you know, some of the abuse and horrors that they've experienced. And then in some cases, even pray. Like, I know of survivors who pray for the people that abuse them. And I just think that's so admirable.
It's a real witness to the strength of faith that they have. I know one of the things, and that's obviously something you've probably learned from them yourself, Luke, you've been encouraging survivors who mightn't have had a chance to meet the Commission to participate in a study that NUI Galway are doing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the kind of history department and various history professors and that in NUIG, they're running a project where it's called Archiving Personal Histories. So they're gathering all these stories from survivors and they're archiving them. And because there is a lot of frustration, of course, that, you know, when the commission were seeking testimony, it was more of an open invitation. So they didn't, for example, send a letter to every known survivor in the country and say, do you want to testify? So for many of the survivors, they actually missed the chance of going before the commission and telling their story. And they're now frustrated, you know, having heard about it afterwards. So for them, I think this is a good avenue. Now, I know that when colleges reopen, it's hoped that this project will restart again and they'll be able to take testimony on that. And I think this is a great way of getting the stories, the true stories of what went on, onto the public record. So I really would encourage survivors to partake in that.
Well, Luke, thank you so much for joining us on the programme today. That's Luke Silk. He is a writer, author and student from Tuam in Galway and studying at NUI Galway. Spirit. You know, I think 2020 was probably a year that we discovered new talents or certainly new hobbies. Maybe one of them was gardening. And maybe you were really looking at your green spaces during another lockdown. Well, maybe you have decided, I'm going to do some new planting or grow some vegetables on my balcony. But then the cold weather comes in and what happens? And what about snow and frost and the impact that has? Well, on the line to give us some gardening tips for this time of year and for those of us who are newly green fingered, we've Anne-Marie Barry of the Dalkey Garden School. Anne-Marie, thanks for joining us on the programme.
Good morning and a very happy new year to you, Wendy.
So tell us a little bit just about, in general, how cold temperatures, it was a frosty morning this morning, yeah. How does that affect our plants and our soil?
Well, it's welcome, for a start. because we need the cold. We need, you know, the plants have adapted over millions of years and thousands of years to live in certain conditions, and they have adapted so much so that, for example, different pests and bugs and different things that are not very healthy for our plants, if we get a cold snap, it kills them, which is great. Where I am this morning, it actually was very mild, so, it was, you know, we have different climates all over this country, and, you know, we can have frost and cold in the middle of the night when we don't know about it. But we will have frost and cold snaps right up into the middle of May. And last year we got really, a lot of people would have noticed it more so than any other time of the year, because there were a lot of people at home and around during the beautiful spring months that we had, and then suddenly there was a cold snap. But that's normal, and it's quite good. It's quite good and very important for our garden.
Okay, so it's a positive. What about people who, I'm putting my hands up here now, Anne-Marie, they, in the summer, they went out, they bought loads of plants, redid loads of stuff, the winter came in, it got dark, it got wet, and yeah, they've all died, and you think, oh my gosh, I've started all over again.
No. Lots of plants hibernate during the winter as well, you know, just like us animals. I've been hibernating myself and just trying to wake up now. Morning, I had my first class online with the Blackrock students called College of Further Education. So, I'm waking up too, believe it or not. No, that's fine. Don't worry about it. This is the advantage of being around, is you'll start to notice the spring shoots. And of course, we have our daffodils, our narcissi are beginning to pop up already. Snowdrops are one of the first little bulbs to start showing off their beautiful little white flowers. We've got plants like hellebores are beginning to flower, other plants called aconites. Lots and lots of little things are beginning to push up their heads through the soil and flower again.
And will these things flower earlier, because overall it's kind of been a milder winter?
No, they have their own clock, and they are usually, it's the light really that triggers them. Because the soil is getting colder and colder, you know, not the other way around, until, you know, then the light rises again and our soil begins to warm up, which takes a while. It's very obvious from sea water temperatures at the moment, which are very low, which is normal for this time of year. Once Christmas is over, the water really, the temperatures really drop, and that's really important. And things like, for example, garlic, which you would plant now, or you plant before Christmas, you plant it now, they need a really cold snap of weather to grow well. And if we don't get that, you won't have very good garlic growing in your garden. And that's one of the problems I have in my garden, because my garden is fairly mild and I don't get those really hard cold snaps. So as a result of that, my garlic doesn't grow very well. So it's really good to understand these things so you're not beating yourself up about your plants not growing well. It's because they're also, if you can keep a good diary, which I would in theory like to do, and I don't, about the temperatures at a particular time, it's very interesting to look back and say, that's why. And actually, just talking about light, one of the most important things we should be doing now at the moment in our gardens is looking after our wildlife. Besides taking cuttings, we can take root cuttings of different plants, we can sow different seeds, but really it's looking after nature in our garden, because they do a great job for us during the year, eating slugs, eating snails, the aphids, different things like that, you know, managing our gardens for us when we need their help. So birds, for example, are probably at the top of the scale there, and feeding birds is a good idea, but birds are wild, so be careful. You know, one of the things I would suggest really is make sure you have water in your garden for visiting creatures, and that includes birds. And we really need birds in our gardens. And at this time of the year, you know, if it's very cold, obviously, you know, they there isn't as much food for them. But they know how to look after themselves as well. But one of the big problems that we're having now is that with more and more streetlights, we're more urbanized, and it is affecting. It is affecting birds, because when they think it's day, it's actually night. And as a result of that, they're finding, there was a study carried out in the United States in California by the California Polytechnic State University, and the results were issued in November 2020, which is quite recently. And they found that even in open environments, grasslands and wetlands, that birds, and in forested environments, that birds are nesting earlier. 18 days, which means that they're going to be laying their eggs earlier, which means then the chicks are going to be there looking to be fed, and the insects and the rest of the feeding population they need to feed the chicks is not available to them, so the chicks die. So it's you know, something that we really have to be more aware of.
In looking out for them and looking after them. What about just in general, have you found, Anne Marie, about just lockdowns and just how much we need these green spaces?
Oh, listen, there have been studies done on all of this in the past, and we have known for a long time how important green spaces are to the environment. But, you know, I think even Galway, my own city, where we were surrounded by green spaces, i.e. rocky spaces, because Connemara, et cetera, but we also the lake and the sea and everything like that. But in the city centre itself, in the centre of the town, there were green spaces there, and they've all been built on now. And the result of that is that, and that's happening all over the place. And you might say, okay, people can get out into the countryside and get the green spaces there. No, you need it on your doorstep, and you need to be able to go out and not only to get the air. Walking is great. You're getting the sunshine and you're there. But there are things that you get for working in your garden, out in your garden, that you don't get in a built-up area. And green spaces are absolutely vital. And also from the point of view of just drainage, you know, hard concrete is not a good idea. Where does the water go? You know, we need our soft spaces. We need our grass. We need our, you know, we need everything. And we also really, really need to feed our insects. Because if we don't have insects, and there's a huge drop in insect numbers in the world, it means that we don't have food for the birds. The birds then don't eat the pests that we want. It's a whole cycle.
Yeah, it's a cycle that we could help out in that. Well, Anne-Marie, as always, thank you so much for some fantastic gardening advice, and we shall talk to you again soon. That's Anne-Marie Byrne from the Dalkey Garden School. If you want to get in touch with her, you can go to dalkeygardenschool.com.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.